Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Prisoners of the Bashaw, the 19-month captivity of American sailors in Tripoli, 1803 to 1805, by Frederick C. Liner, narrated by Tom Parks. The race is not won by the swift, nor the battle by the valiant. For the time of mischance comes to all, and a man cannot even know his time, as fishes are enmeshed in a fatal net, and as birds are trapped in a snare, so men are caught at the time of calamity when it comes upon them without warning. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 11 through 12. Introduction. The grounding of the U.S. frigate Philadelphia on a reef off Tripoli, modern-day Libya, in October 1803, led to the capture of 307 American sailors and Marines by a distant enemy in North Africa. This book is about what happened to the men in captivity, how they lived and labored, what they thought, and how they reacted to being slaves in an Islamic regime. No previous account of the Barbary Wars focuses on them and looks at the larger naval and diplomatic events from their perspective. These topics have been dealt with only in passing, or not at all, in the standard histories. The Philadelphia's officers and crew remained prisoners of the Bashaw, a variation of the Turkish word Pasha, for 19 months until the Tripolitan War ended in June 1805. The war came to be largely about them. The question for President Thomas Jefferson, for the diplomats and naval officers offshore, and even for the American people, was how to free their countrymen. The Tripolitans treated the U.S. naval officers far differently than the people. For the officers, regarded as high-status gentlemen, the strain of captivity was, in large part, psychological. Even so, they considered themselves slaves, not prisoners of war. The crew worked as slave laborers, many serving as human pack animals. Often beaten, usually underfed, they reacted to events and rumors around them. Some died in captivity, some converted to Islam to escape their dreary lives, others tried to undermine their captors. This book raises larger, timeless questions about moral conduct in captivity, about the early American experience with the Islamic world, about slavery across cultures, and about the roles of diplomacy and force to redeem hostages from foreign lands. Never before had the United States had so many of its people held captive in the Islamic world, and never before had the American public been riveted for so long on the news from Barbary. Some of the captives' letters, after a slow journey across the Atlantic, appeared in contemporary newspapers. They are rediscovered here and add context to a broadly Orientalist American view of the Arab world. The irony of being slaves far away from America was not lost on the officers and crew. Some of the officers wrote thoughtfully about the nature of their slavery in the Islamic world. Unfortunately, only a few Americans questioned how their country could assert moral indignation about the captivity of a few hundred white Christian sailors when America held in slavery millions of black Africans, some of whom were Muslim. This account also raises questions about the relation of force and diplomacy, as it captures the complexity of the negotiations, the role played by foreign diplomats, and the critical role of ransom money. The loss of the Philadelphia on the rocks off Tripoli is sometimes employed as proof of a core precept of principle and policy. The United States does not pay ransom for hostages. This bold statement is wrong historically and sometimes has caused tragic results. As the story of the American prisoners in Tripoli shows, history is not so tidy and the lessons are not so clear. Prologue. On the last day of October 1803, the frigate Philadelphia was sailing alone, close to the North African coast, 7 or 8 miles east of the city of Tripoli, hoping to intercept any ships trying to enter Tripoli Harbor. Faced by Tripolitan threats to seize American merchant ships and enslave American sailors in the war that began in 1801, the U.S. Navy had spent 2 years in intermittent and lackluster blockading that had achieved little. The Philadelphia was the lead ship of the 3rd Naval Squadron, sent to the Mediterranean to reassert the blockade. At 9 a.m., a Philadelphia lookout spotted a sail ahead and inshore of the frigate, standing in toward the harbor before an easterly breeze. Captain William Bainbridge immediately ordered his frigate to chase the strange sail, a small Zeebeck cruiser, which hoisted Tripolitan colors and bore away for safety toward the harbor. A Zeebeck was a distinctive Mediterranean craft, often used by corsairs, with a forward-leaning foremast, billowing lateen sails, a wide beam, a narrow hull, and a pronounced overhanging bow and stern. In the age of sail, stern chases could be agonizingly slow. A slight difference in speed meant that catching up with a ship running before the wind might take hours. At about 11 a.m., in about 7 fathoms of water, 42 feet, the Philadelphia came within range of the fleeing Zeebeck. Bainbridge ordered the 18-pounder cannon in the bow to be run out and then to open fire. The Philadelphia's bow chasers fired a 5-inch diameter, 18-pound cannonball that had a maximum range of just under 3,000 yards. The gun crews began a slow, methodical fire, hoping a lucky shot would knock away a yardarm or dismast the fleeing corsair, but all the shots missed. As the frigate approached Tripoli, Bainbridge grew concerned about the depth of the sea, because fully loaded, the Philadelphia drew about 18 feet of water forward and 19 and a half feet aft. He ordered seamen to the bow and sides of the ship to take soundings. Each man used a deep sea line with knots for counting the depth and a lead weight at the end to make sure that the line reached bottom. The line was tossed ahead and pulled up when the ship was directly overhead. Oddly, for a ship blockading a foreign port, the Philadelphia did not have a reliable chart of the approaches to Tripoli. Bainbridge's first lieutenant, David Porter, at his station near the captain on the quarterdeck, reminded him that he had been in these same waters some months earlier when he was the first lieutenant of the frigate New York. He assured Bainbridge there was ample water under the ship. Bainbridge deferred to his judgment. Even so, Bainbridge worried about sailing any farther inshore. Never lacking in self-confidence, Porter responded there was no danger yet, and there was time to try a few more shots to wing the Zeebeck. At 11:30 a.m., the leadsman reported the ship was still in 7 fathoms of water, speeding along at 7 or 8 knots. But all the Philadelphia shots missed. The Zeebeck was clearly going to find sanctuary in Tripoli Harbor, and Bainbridge decided to give up the pursuit. The captain ordered the helm up, and the Philadelphia turned away to head back to deeper water. Bainbridge sent Porter with a spyglass up to the mizzenmast top, a platform a third of the way up the rearmost mast, to look into the harbor to see how many enemy cruisers were in port. Porter started to climb up the rigging. The Philadelphia went another 1,200 feet when the water suddenly shoaled. Then, with an appalling crash, the ship struck submerged rocks. A 1,240-ton ship, cruising at 7 or 8 knots, running onto an underground reef, makes a grinding racket, and the big frigate shuddered as she came to a stop. She had run aground atop Kaliusa Reef, about 3 or 4 miles outside the harbor, with her bow all the way to the forechains, a third of the length of the ship, on the rocks. The forward part of the ship jutted out of water, and her stern sloped down on a steep angle on her port left side. The ship canted so far over that her lee gun deck ports were on a level with the water's edge, as Porter later recounted. Marine Private William Ray, writing in the officer's wardroom, heard and felt the ship crash and lurch, and feet running on the deck overhead. Ray ran up the hatchway to the main deck and immediately saw the ship's bow up and that she lay partly on top of the reef. Everyone looked shocked. Bainbridge was an experienced seaman, and whatever his emotions, he reacted professionally, with what Porter called great coolness and deliberation. Bainbridge first tried to drive the Philadelphia over the reef by setting more sail, but she was stuck fast. He then ordered a ship's boat lowered into the water from the stern to take soundings to determine the depth of the water around the ship. The soundings revealed that the sea was deeper astern. Bainbridge ordered sailors aloft to lay all sails aback, loosed the top gallant sails, and set a heavy press of canvas on the ship, blowing fresh to get her off to have his ship sail backward. Still, the frigate did not budge. Bainbridge then did what commanders classically do when ships run aground. He tried to lighten the ship. He ordered all the cannon run aft, meaning the crew began the Herculean effort of rolling the cannon down the slanted deck. An 18-pounder cannon was an unwieldy monster, 8 feet long and weighing more than 2 tons. The wooden carriage in which the gun was placed, with its iron ring bolts and linchpins, weighed hundreds of pounds more. Teams of men, spurned on by the bosun's mates shouting or cursing encouragement, used brute force to push, pull, and drag the heavy guns aft down the deck, but the frigate stayed stuck. 3 heavy sea anchors were cast away over the bow, and Bainbridge ordered the water in the bilges pumped out, but the ship did not move. He then ordered most of the cannon to be tipped overboard, leaving only a few in the stern to defend the ship against enemy gunboats that, having seen the Philadelphia in distress, were making their way out of the harbor toward the stranded frigate. One by one, the cannon went over the side. Dumping the cannon did not free the Philadelphia from the reef, and the few cannon that remained on board could not be run out and trained around to bear on the approaching gunboats. With a growing sense of despair, Bainbridge called his officers to the quarterdeck to seek advice. As a last resort for lightening the ship forward, he ordered the Philadelphia's foremast chopped down. When it fell, the main top gallant mast came down with it, still connected by some of the standing rigging. Still, the frigate did not budge. As Bainbridge put it, our fate was direfully fixed, as was his ship. 3 Tripolitan gunboats warily approached the frigate, even as more gunboats were seen being rigged in the port to come out. From a distance, the gunboats began firing their cannon. They aimed high to spare the frigate's hull. No cannonball hit the hull of the Philadelphia, although several went through her rigging. Bainbridge ordered the taffrail, the handrail at the stern, cut away to make room for the few cannon left aboard to bear on the gunboats. The cannon thundered out, but the shots flew wide and over the enemy gunboats. Because the guns' muzzles did not protrude beyond the ship's sides, firing the cannon caused the frigate's own bulwarks to catch fire. While the blaze was quickly put out, the heel of the ship made her guns useless. With the Tripolitan cannonballs whizzing by overhead, and more gunboats sailing out to join the fray, the bosun, George Hodge, approached Bainbridge and suggested a way to try to save the ship. A team of sailors would row a boat directly astern and drop an anchor in the water. When the anchor stuck fast to the bottom, sailors aboard the frigate, heaving together, would wind the anchor chain around the capstan again and again, pulling the Philadelphia off the reef by brute force, a maneuver called kedging. Bainbridge rejected the idea. He and Porter believed that none of the Philadelphia's boats was large or sturdy enough to carry a heavy sea anchor. But even if a boat could handle the anchor, kedging would be in plain sight of the Tripolitan gunboats, which would close the range and direct their fire on the boat, and the sailors would all be sacrificed. Still, it is hard to understand why Bainbridge did not make any attempt, perhaps with another ship's boat sent out with a small carronade in the bow to provide covering fire, even if some of the Americans might have been killed. The Philadelphia was a big frigate with a large crew, including 40 Marines. Her situation was dire, but not immediately hopeless. The Marine Corps had not yet received renown as a fighting force, but even in 1803, the Marines provided a steady corps of marksmen. At battle stations, the Marines assembled on the quarterdeck and in the tops to shoot their muskets at enemy sailors and to repel boarders. Warships in the age of sail were equipped with boarding nets, which could be raised up the sides of the ships by blocks, pulleys in the masts, to slow enemy attackers from coming aboard. Boarders attempting to come onto the Philadelphia would have to cut through the rope netting, even as the defenders fired on them with muskets and pistols. If Bainbridge had ordered the ship defended to the last extremity, Tripolitan sailors who made it through the netting would have to contend with more than 300 American sailors and Marines fighting them at close quarters, firing weapons and slashing at them with pikes, boarding axes, and cutlasses. As Private Ray put it, even without her cannon, the crew had everything else to defend ourselves with, and with determined men, we might have kept off the enemy for that night. Not only would boarding have been perilous for would-be attackers, but also the gunboats would likely not have fired into the hull of the ship, given the Tripolitan's obvious goals of capturing the frigate in as undamaged condition as possible. And no one knew what a new day might bring. A gale of wind might blow the frigate off the reef. A storm might drive the gunboats back into port for days. Perhaps a ship from a friendly nation might miraculously appear. Moreover, the American sailors and Marines had not lost heart. The sailors at their battle stations called out to Bainbridge to defend the ship. It was Bainbridge's duty as captain to defend his ship to the utmost, but it was not to be. At 4 p.m., Bainbridge again convened his officers on the quarterdeck, the Tripolitan gunboats arranged in a rough crescent on her windward, high side, firing cannonballs whistling over their heads. The officers agreed there was no hope in saving the ship from a coming attack, and immobilized as she was, no way of defending her if the Tripolitans aimed into the hull. Bainbridge later compared his situation to a man bound to a stake being attacked by a man with weapons. The 29-year-old Bainbridge had surrendered a ship before, the only captain in the then 6-year history of the U.S. Navy to have done so. Now, he was confronted with that nightmare again, lowering the Stars and Stripes from his once beautiful but now mutilated frigate. As Bainbridge wrote a few days later, the stress of having withstood the fire of the gunboats for 4 hours and a reinforcement coming out from Tripoli without the least chance of injuring them in resistance was overwhelming. The only alternative to hauling down the flag, which he thought only fanatics would support, was to blow up the ship. But Bainbridge thought that such conduct would not stand acquitted before God or man, and he had no right to consign 306 other men to their deaths just because he was the captain of the ship. Ray later thought the surrender was unnecessary and premature, and it was true that the ship had not even been grazed by the cannon fire, and not a single man aboard had been killed or wounded. But Bainbridge thought that if they had tried to fight 10 gunboats carrying 18 and 24 pounders, which could take their station on each quarter, certainly would have cut us all to pieces. A few minutes before sunset, Bainbridge, in tears, ordered the colors down. According to Ray, the crew was shocked, and the quartermaster at the ensign halyards positively refused to obey the captain's orders when he was ordered to lower the flag. He was threatened to be run through with a sword, and a midshipman seized the halyards and executed the command amidst the general murmuring of the crew. The commanders of the gunboats, arranged warily around the frigate, suspected the lowered flag was a ruse. Bainbridge had to send out Porter and midshipman James Biddle in the Philadelphia's barge to convince the Tripolitans that the surrender was real. One gunboat opened fire on the barge, but the American boat rowed onward, toward the gunboat thought to be carrying the Tripolitan flotilla commander. One of the nearer gunboats decided to seize the barge, sending out her own boat to row straight for the Americans. According to Biddle, 20 enemy sailors bristling with sabers and pistols jumped from the Tripolitan boat onto the barge, and two seized Lieutenant Porter, and two others seized me. My coat was soon off, my vest unbuttoned, and my cravat torn from my neck. I thought, for my own part, I should not have time to count my beads, but we soon perceived that their violence was only with the view of getting from us whatever money or valuables we might have concealed about our persons. Biddle lost his sword and money, except for 20 gold coins he had slipped into his boots, and the American sailors were robbed of everything except what they had on their backs, and even part of that was stripped off. Meanwhile, Bainbridge tried to make the Philadelphia a sorry prize. He ordered William Godby, the ship's carpenter, to take his mates below and drill holes in the frigate's bottom to scuttle her. He ordered the gunner, Richard Stevenson, to flood the magazine to ruin the gunpowder. He directed midshipman Daniel Todd Patterson to destroy the signal book, and the crew tossed overboard everything that might be useful to the enemy. To record the exact spot where the Philadelphia grounded, Bainbridge had an officer take triangulated bearings with a compass of charted rocks on the coast, the spire of a mosque in Tripoli, and an old fort. But in all the last-minute activity, Bainbridge made an unpardonable error. He forgot to destroy his orders and letter book, which would soon give Tripoli accurate intelligence about the U.S. Navy and the squadron. In a pathetic scene, Bainbridge mustered the crew aft, told them their wages would continue to be accrued while they were in captivity, spoke hopefully of a rapid ransom once America learned of their capture, and asked them to bear up to what was coming. Before the Tripolitans arrived, the crew dashed below to grab whatever clothes and personal items they had stowed away, and the ship's slop chests were opened on the gun deck, where the men helped themselves to extra clothing. They bundled up with several handkerchiefs around their necks and layers of shirts, trousers, and coats, and they crammed their pockets with food and their possessions. They provided a laughable image in a nightmarish scene to a literary-minded man like Ray, who thought they looked like buffoons or like Falstaff in Shakespeare's plays. Then the Tripolitan corsairs swarmed aboard. Chapter 1. Barbary. The Barbary Powers was the name European countries gave to the Islamic regimes that stretched thousands of miles along the North African coast, the Maghreb, from the independent kingdom of Morocco in the west to Algiers, the largest and most powerful entity, to Tunis and to Tripoli. Morocco was ruled by a king, though often called an emperor, Algiers by a Dey, Tunis by a Bey, and Tripoli by a Bashaw. While Morocco had the most strategic position, having ports on both the Atlantic and Mediterranean, and holding the ground pinching the Mediterranean across from the British garrison at Gibraltar, the other powers were situated where they could easily interdict European trade with Mediterranean port cities. For centuries, the rulers in Barbary unleashed their corsairs on European merchant ships, capturing them as prizes, selling off their cargoes, and holding their crews and passengers as slaves for ransom. The corsairs were not pirates, although then and now they have been called that. Pirates are seafaring criminals, subject to no authority and operating outside any notion of law. But the Barbary rulers controlled their corsairs' actions and sometimes own part of or the entire Corsair vessel. The captures provided critical money for the Barbary treasuries. At the height of their power in the 16th century, the Barbary Corsairs upended Mediterranean trade and etched fear deep into the imaginations of Europeans, a fear carried across the Atlantic to the New World by their brazen assaults on the coasts of Spain, Tuscany, Sicily, the Greek islands, and as far off as Ireland, carrying off the populations of whole villages to bring back to Barbary. The seized Europeans were held as slaves and put to hard labor until they might be ransomed. Western literature reflected the wide fascination with and deep fear of Barbary captivity. In 1575, Corsairs captured the Spanish writer Miguel Cervantes, who was enslaved for 5 years in Algiers. Before Trinitarian friars supplied his ransom payment, Cervantes was a galley slave rower, a subject he wrote about in two plays and in Don Quixote. Although the great English novel Robinson Crusoe, 1719, is a shipwreck story, Daniel Defoe begins the tale with Crusoe's capture by Celie rovers, corsairs from Morocco, and his 2 years as a slave to the Moors. The same fear and fascination gripped Americans. In 1794, Susanna Haswell Rosen, the first American best-selling novelist and sister to two men soon to become naval officers, wrote the play Slaves in Algiers, which was staged at the Chestnut Street Theater in Philadelphia. In 1797, Royal Tyler's novel, The Algerine Captive, appeared, in which the main character is captured and enslaved, though Tyler critiqued the slavery of blacks in America to be worse than Barbary slavery. Dozens of other Barbary captivity narratives, novels, and plays emerged from American authors around the turn of the 19th century. By the early 18th century, the Barbary powers were semi-autonomous regimes, each with its own military and naval forces, finances, and diplomatic relations with the rest of the world. Although the Barbary powers had shed the historic control the Ottoman Turks had previously exercised, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire at Constantinople, as spiritual leader of Islam, retained a certain amount of influence. The Barbary rulers acknowledged their nominal dependence by paying annual tribute to the Sublime Porte. At the same time, all the European nations negotiated treaties establishing a system of annual tributary payments and presents to the Barbary powers, although over the centuries they occasionally sent naval squadrons to the Mediterranean to bombard a Barbary city to lower the price. In exchange for money and gifts, the king, Dey, Bey, or Bashaw would allow that country's ships to navigate freely to Mediterranean ports in southern Europe and the Levant. For example, between 1785 and 1790, Spain paid Algiers 4.5 million Spanish dollars. Britain and France each paid 15,000 guineas to Morocco in the 1780s. At the close of an inconclusive war in 1792, Venice paid Tunis 40,000 sequins. As late as 1798, Tunis sent a raiding force to the village of Carloforte on the island of San Pietro off Sardinia that seized 900 people and took them to Tunis to hold in slavery for ransom. Tripoli was the weakest Barbary power. But even so, in 1795, Spain paid it 20,000 Spanish dollars and provided a ship and 18 ship carpenters to build more corsairs as the price of a treaty. And Venice the same year paid 4,000 sequins to confirm its treaty and pay tribute in arrears. Slavery in the Barbary world for European and American seamen was not the same as slavery in the American South for black Africans. In the Maghreb, a Quranic distinction was made between captivity and slavery. European and American Christian seamen, mostly white, but some black, captured by Barbary corsairs, could be ransomed by a monetary payment. While in captivity, they were treated as slaves, forced to contribute grinding physical labor. Although some, for a fee, could
sample complete. Ready to continue?